Tonight my guest is Edwidge Dundicott. Are you there, Edwidge?
Yes, I am. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Edwidge. Edwidge was born in Haiti in 1969 and came to the U.S. when she was 12. She holds degrees from Barnard College and Brown University and has taught creative writing at New York University. Her work has been translated into 10 languages. She's won many awards, in 1992 a James Michener Caribbean Writing Fellowship, a 1993 Essence Magazine Fiction Award, a 1994 Barnard College Woman of Achievement Award, and a 1995 Pushcart Prize. The New York Times Magazine, Harper's Bazaar, Jane, and Ms. Magazine all selected Ms. Dundicott as one of the most important young women to watch. She was chosen as one of 20 best young American novelists by Granta in 1996. Edwidge Dundicott lives in New York, and her newest novel, The Farming of Bones, was just released. It's a wonderful book. It's about the 1937 massacre of Haitians at the border of the Dominican Republic. Edwidge, what moved you to write this book?
I grew up around, in Haiti, around the children of many migrants, and I was one of them myself. My parents were living here in the United States, and I was there, and there were a lot of the children whose parents had migrated to the Dominican Republic, and a lot of them had not come back. And of course, as often happens, in the absence of people, narratives sprout, you know, tales of what possibly might have happened. Mm-hmm. And this massacre was one of the stories that was often told in the absence of the people who had gone from Haiti to the Dominican Republic to work in the sugar cane.
How long did it take you to write?
It took, because it's set in 1937, and my mother was born in 1935, so it's certainly is out of my time. And it took about 5 years with the research, and in the actual writing took about 3 years.
What sort of research did you do?
I did a lot of reading first in order to get a sense of the story, and then I would go to some of the places where some of these things happened. And after that, I tried to talk to people. It was hard to find survivors because it had been about almost 60 years. But I spoke to some family members who had known people who had survived this event and read the testimonials that were taken from different sources. So basically trying to get as much into the story as possible.
Would you read a page or two for our listeners and give them a taste of The Farming of Bones?
Yes. I'll read from a part where Amabel, the main character, has just crossed over the border with a friend of hers who is dead, and they are going into a border clinic. And this is the story is told in the voice of Amabel.
Okay. And
we were found the next morning at dawn by a priest walking the savannas looking for survivors. Eve had carried Odette's body some distance from the riverbank in the dark, far enough that we could no longer see the river. The priest called for help, and suddenly we were surrounded by men and women in different stages of hurt and healing, asking where we were from, had we seen this and that person from this or that mill. Someone took Odette without questioning us. She seemed small and pliable, now weightless in the stranger's arms. We followed the one carrying her to another field, dotted with large tents. Eve limped onward, his eyes fixed on Odette. "What was her name?" asked the tired-looking priest with an open notebook in his hand. "Eve," said Odette. The man with Odette in his arms was walking on the side of the road where the corpses had been awled and laid out in rows. Priest and a bishop in full dress performed the last rites for each of the dead. We did not ask where Odette would be buried, for we knew she would likely have to share her grave with all the others there. Besides, the priest had already moved on to someone else. I took one last look at Odette's face. There was a stillness to it I nearly envied. She did not look like someone death had taken by surprise. Her body had very hastily eased into it, her open hands, her bent knees, the relaxed face. I must have been standing over her body for several hours. Wherever I go, I will always be standing over her body. No farewell could be enough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Edwidge Dondekut, author of the new book, The Farming of Bones. Edwidge, would you talk about the theme of this book a bit?
I would say the theme of the book is really about memory, about collective memory and cultural memory. And I've always been personally interested in writing that in a singular voice attempts to tell the larger stories. And so this is what this book is trying to do, to recollect from the perspective of one woman a large historical incident in the same way that, for example, the Diary of Anne Frank tells a larger story, even as it's one girl telling the story. So that the theme is really about remembering and telling, naming in silence, which, as I found out in talking to different people, is felt to be the burden of the survivor, you know, to not to let the story die, to name things and remember together collectively, but also individually.
Mm-hmm. Do you find common themes running through all of your work?
I would say probably, Barbara, memory would be the common theme for me. And perhaps that has to do with the experience of migrating, you know, of coming from a different culture into this culture where you feel like you're carrying certain things with you that you do not want to. You want to hold on to,
mm-hmm.
Even as you're becoming immersed in a new culture. So I would say memory is probably a common theme in my work. All of my characters, I find at different moments, are trying to remember or at least not to forget.
Hmm. How did the 1937 massacre affect you or your family? It was many years before you were even born, but how did you find it? Was it an effect that you felt as a child?
I felt it in the sense that, and I think a lot of us feel it in the same way, that people are still leaving Haiti to go to the Dominican Republic to work in the sugar cane. And so it's something that's ever present in the sense that because of the poverty in Haiti, people continue to be vulnerable to these kinds of things because they still migrate there. As I said, I knew a lot of people. I even had some family members who went over to work in the cane. And so there was always that story with us. And because we also live, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, we share, it's one, two people on one small island. So you have the constant tensions. There are moments where Haiti took over the Dominican Republic, and so you have these tensions going back and forth of two people, you know, two different peoples trying to live on one island.
Mm-hmm. How did you choose the point of view of Annabelle?
Well, it took me many, many different trials, Barbara, because I wasn't sure how to best tell the story. And just one day, I had the character because she's based on an actual woman who worked in the home of a colonel. And when the order was given by General Trujillo, who was a dictator then at the time, this woman was slaughtered at the dinner table by her patron, her boss. And so I knew I wanted to tell the story of that woman, but I wanted her to live. And so that's how that began. And once, as a lot of your listeners might know, might have experienced, once you pick a point of view character, you know, you have to do what, how much is she supposed to know? How much does she have access to? So all these things came into play later. But as soon as Annabelle sprouted, then it felt that it had clicked somehow, that there was no other voice that could tell the story. And that's then I felt like I had made the right choice.
Mm-hmm. Do you know your story start to finish before you start writing?
No. I think it's, isn't a Yale doctor who had said that, you know, writing is like driving with in a storm with the headlights on. I think that's usually my approach, and I don't like to know the start to finish. I think I have some vague idea sometimes where it will end up, but I love to go on the journey with the characters. You know, I like their moments of surprise. You know, where something happens as you're writing that you didn't know was coming. I like that. I think that's also part of it, a part of it that keeps it interesting for the writer.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that an active part of the writing, and I enjoy that very much, the not knowing.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you revise as you go along, or do you do entire drafts and then start over again?
For shorter pieces, I just try to do an entire draft before I revise. But for in a novel, I usually revise at some point. I'll read all that I have and then see where, you know, and before I continue sometimes. But I find myself revising when I'm stuck, you know, when I'm in the murderous middle, as mm-hmm. they say. And so when I feel like I'm stuck for a couple of days and I can't go any further, then I'll go back and revise what I already have.
Mm-hmm. You've accomplished so much, especially when one considers that you're not yet 30. Have you always known you were a writer?
I've always known that I loved writing, that there's few things in the world that I feel like give me as much pleasure as to sit down and write, truly. So I've always known that I've loved it, but I didn't, you know, it's like Gloria Naylor said that she didn't call herself a writer until she wrote her fourth book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it similarly in the same way, not with the numbers, but in the sense that you feel like it's something you have to earn before you say you're a writer. So I've always loved to read, and I think my wanting to be a writer comes from my love, my great love for reading. But I didn't, you know, I didn't always easily call myself a writer because I had such great, you know, such great esteem for it and such great love for it. And I sometimes feel like I'm probably a bigger reader than I am a writer, by any means. But I feel honored and humbled to be a writer, you know, just because I think it's a really great thing.
What writers have had a special impact on you as a writer?
Well, there are two categories of writers that have influenced me. There was a Haitian woman writer, for example, who wrote under the dictatorship in Haiti, and she wrote very bravely. And her name was Marie Chauvet, and she's always been a great influence for me. And writers in the United States, for example, Paul Marshall, who I've started teaching with at NYU. It was amazing, that she entered my life, because when I read her novel Brown Girl, Brown Stone at 15, I just thought she had written my life. And so I would say Paul Marshall, you know, Toni Morrison, and a lot of the wonderful immigrant writers too, like Sandra Cisneros and Julia Alvarez. So I mean, I think we're lucky in the sense that there is such a broad range of writing in English, you know, to read and to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. What is the reaction by Haitians to your work?
Well, I think it's like anything else. There's some people who like it and some people who don't like it. And but I think there's a curiosity about it both here and in Haiti, because we are seeing a generation of writers emerge out of the immigration, out of the migration from Haiti, and there are writers now, who are born in Haiti who are the children of Haitian parents who are writing in Spanish or writing in English. There was a quicker transition to the Haitian writers who went to French-speaking countries, you know, who could continue to write in French, but it's still, you know, with us, it's a little different because we had to learn, we're writing in a whole different language that we learned when we migrated. So there is, I think it's, you know, there's a lot of us coming up in my, you know, in my situation who are the children of immigrants or immigrants ourselves who are writing in the language of the place where we end up. So there's that. I think it's looked at in the way, you know, we're sort of writers of the diaspora.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Your book, Breath, Eyes, Memory, was published in 1994, and it was an Oprah book club pick. How did that commercial fame affect you and your work?
Well, it happened, you know, it happened this summer when she picked the book this summer. I can't say that, I think it, you know, one thing that the Oprah's book club does is that it absolutely brings more readers to a book, you know, and a lot of people encounter the book who might not have before. But I don't think it, when it comes to the work itself, I mean, in the end, it's ultimately you and the paper,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you have to do. You're alone with your paper, and every piece of writing is you start at zero, you start over. So, it's not affected sort of that part of my work,
mm-hmm.
you know, my relationship with the word and the paper.
Mm. Are you real structured in your process? Do you write daily, the same time, same place?
When I'm working on something specific, I try to write daily. If I'm home and I'm not traveling, I try to write daily. I write at night, which for me makes it easier to sort of shut out outside stimulus. It makes it easier to call forth in my mind a different world. You know, the world of the story. I try to be as disciplined as I can about it. I can't write when I'm traveling, for example, but if I am in the middle of something, then I can add a few pages here and there when I'm traveling, but it's hard to start something once I'm not in a stable place.
Mm-hmm. Do your dreams feed your work at all?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like my dreams feed my life, and actually I do keep a journal, and every once in a while when I write one of my dreams in my journal, I'll see kind of I'll try to figure it out and maybe I can't, but then a couple of days something happens and I will say, oh, that's what this dream was trying to tell me.
Mm-hmm.
So I already have a strong life connection with my dreams. So there are times when things that I dream about end up as stories. So I do feel I'm very conscious of my dreams, which I think makes it, then it becomes part of my work in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, in reading The Farming of Bones, there are passages that are so dreamlike that they seem to be lifted right out of a dream.
Well, the character has a lot of dreams and in the book, and probably because of my own personal connections with dreams, but that's one of the things that sustains her are her dreams. You know, her dreams sustain her, so that does get into the story.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider your work to be at all autobiographical?
I think there are autobiographical elements to my work. I consider my work more sort of emotional autobiography. It's not lifted from my. It's not all lifted from my experience, but the work is true to a lot of emotions. You know, a lot of feelings that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part of it that's very real and concrete for me.
I have to ask you, there's a photo of you and Jill Cremins's The Writer's Desk.
Uh-huh.
And you look to be in this room with 2x4s surrounding you.
Uh-huh.
It's such an interesting picture. Where are you in that photo?
Well, I'm in my house where I write, and I have sort of a desk underneath a bunk bed that I've always had.
Ah, okay.
So I sleep on top of it, and then I write underneath it.
That's interesting.
So that's where that is. And that's really an interesting book, actually, in terms of the places people write.
Oh, yeah, I love that book.
Only thing that wasn't true to that is that I got dressed up for the picture. I don't sit down in my nice clothes and write.
You looked very nice. What sort of pressure does, you know, you've gotten so much coverage from top publications. Does that create any kind of pressure on you as a writer to produce more, better, you know, the next one?
Well, I think I was very lucky in the sense that, you know, that, and it is, and it's frankly, you do feel like it's luck, because there are a lot of wonderful writers, and who knows why some people get picked, you know, more than others for things, and so I've been lucky in that sense. But I think, you know, for example, I'm not in any rush to do things just to stay out. I mean, I don't feel like that's who I am. You know, I feel like that's my whole life. I love writing, and I'll sort of always will write. But for me personally, I feel like I've been lucky that people have paid attention to the stuff that I've been doing, because in other ways the work is very important to me. You know, the topics are important to me, the things that I'm passionate about. But I really don't feel the pressure in that sense, because I feel like I've been so lucky to have been able to tell the stories that I have been able to, that let's say if I never write another book, that's fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to do the work. You know, I don't want to spend the rest of my life chasing what could have been just a very lucky moment in my life.
Yes.
I try as much as I can to accept it. And I've really given this a lot of thought. I don't want to become like a tragic victim of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
someone who's spending the rest of her life trying to capture this. At the end of the day, you know, I just want to do my work. You know, I just want to write.
We're about at the end of our time. Do you have any advice for the writers listening?
Just don't let anything deter you. You know, just write. Write as much as you can, and read as much as you can. I would say just sit down and write. A lot of people are afraid to make the commitment to writing because they don't want to fail. You know, Tom Jones says that in an interview that he does. Like, you feel like, oh, if you don't train, it's like a boxer. If you don't train hard, then you feel like if you fail, you have an excuse. But make that commitment to your work and give it a couple of hours like you do things in your life, and just do it. You know, just write. Just write. I think that's the most important thing.
Well, Edward Dondekot, author of The Farming of Bones, I thank you for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Much luck with your book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Tonight my guest is Philip Reed, author of 2 car noir thrillers, Bird Dog and his most recent, Lowrider. He's been nominated for the Edgar and Anthony Awards for mystery writing. The Chicago Tribune has called Lowrider deliciously edgy. Philip began his writing career as a night police reporter for the City News Bureau of Chicago and later wrote for the Rocky Mountain News in Denver. In 1982, he moved to L.A., where he directed his first play, True Blues. His plays have been staged in L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. He's written several nonfiction books, including Candidly, Alan Funt, and Free Throw, and has also written episodes of several TV dramas, including Miami Vice. He lives in Long Beach with his wife and poet Vivian Blackwell and their 2 sons, Andrew and Tony. Glad to have you on the show, Phil.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Why are your books called car noir thrillers? Did you coin the term car noir?
I wish I had.
That's
I'm not
great.
That clever. Car noir came from, well, first of all, I have to say that when I wrote the books, I didn't realize that my first book, Bird Dog, was noir until it came out and people started calling it noir. But then when the first book was reviewed by the New York Times and it was called A Car Noir Thriller.
Interesting.
So then when the second, I received the jacket for the second book, Lowrider, they had on there a Harold Dodge mystery. And it seems like every book is sold by so-and-so mystery,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'm kind of a person that likes to do things differently. So I said, well, what about a car noir thriller? And next thing I know, I'm getting a jacket with just that on it.
Had you intended to write a series character, Harold? Harold Dodge?
Well, I guess I say that technically it's not a series. It's a book and a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear so much about series, and I thought that people would be jumping up and down and trying to convince me to write a series, but nobody has done that, but they definitely wanted a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
But I left him in jeopardy at the end of the sequel, so there's got to be at least one more book.
Right.
And then you can call it a series.
That's interesting. The mysteries thriller genre is a crowded field, and what makes Howard Dodge different?
Well, Harold Dodge. sorry.
Harold.
Yeah, another H word. Harold Dodge is, Well, I wrote Harold Dodge to be... Well, I wrote him with a very specific idea in mind, and I was very happy that he turned out to be different than, you know, most of the male PIs, you know, the private investigators. First of all, he's not a private investigator. He spends most of the book on the wrong side of the law.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the most noticeable distinguishing characteristic about Harold is that he solves problems by screwing things up. He gets involved, and he thinks it's going to be a simple process of righting a wrong. But things just get worse and worse because of a number of undesirable character traits that he has. And just because of just real dumb bad luck that he brings about on himself because of bad karma.
Mm-hmm.
So things get worse and worse. What I think makes the book interesting is that there's a resolution which is completely unexpected and is not necessarily a flat-out happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
But it achieves more or less the desired result that Harold started out to achieve.
Did you base Harold on anyone in particular or a composite of people you've known, or how did you come up with him?
Well, I once wrote a book about how to buy a used car, and I worked with a guy who had been in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the foibles, I think, came from him. But I think with any good character, there's got to be a merging of yourself with him, which I really shouldn't own up to in public when people read the book and see what a disaster he is.
Well, it's interesting having a used car salesman protagonist.
Yeah, I know.
It's very interesting. Have you ever sold cars?
Only my own, but I've gone and bought cars, and I've helped people buy cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a dramatic and a kind of a different thing, and it definitely touches everybody's lives.
Sure does.
There's some rather ugly scenes in car dealerships, and a lot of people have said, oh, you know, I've been through that. I can really relate.
Hmm. Will you read a page or two?
Oh, sure.
To give our listeners a taste, and... Phil Reed's going to read from Lowrider.
Lowrider is the sequel to Bird Dog, which is the first book. And in it, Harold Dodge comes back and, well, at the end of Bird Dog, there's a body which is unaccounted for. And nobody knows where it is except for Harold. And when he comes back in Lowrider, he realizes that this information could be worth quite a bit of money because you can't collect on an insurance policy until you have a body.
Mm-hmm.
So he dreams of the scheme to come back to L.A., identify the body, and split the money with the widow, whose name is Vicky.
Mm-hmm.
So this takes place rather at the beginning of the book, and it kind of sets things up. And I just wanted to say before I start reading that sometimes people will say, well, you know, your writing is over the top, and I'll just plead guilty of that right away. Because, you know, you can either like it or dislike it,
yeah.
But and most people like it. So anyways, with those apologies.
Well, most instructors will tell students, write over the top. Mm-hmm. And then if you need to rein it in a bit, then you do it.
That's a good point. I mean, when I sit down, I try to tell myself just to go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always pull it back from there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it brings some good things out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is near the beginning of Lowrider. Vicky was in the garage, bending over the engine of an Austin Healey Mark III, with the for sale sign in the windshield. He was tempted to stand there and admire this view of her, but the last thing he needed was to have her turn and catch him at it. So he cleared his throat and said, "Don't see many of those anymore. What is it, a 62?" Her face came out from under the hood and she stood up, staring at him, realizing who he was and not liking it at all, and finally said, "What do you want?" "I'm Harold Dodge. I met you." "I know who you are." She held a 12-millimeter box-end wrench, her muscled forearms smeared black to the elbow. There was nothing, he thought, quite as sexy as a woman with grease on her hands and a chip on her shoulder. "Problem with those," Harold nodded at the Healy. "You could never balance those SU carburetor. Thing runs okay, but it won't idle." "That's why I swapped them out for Weber's," she said. "Only a jerk would run one of these with SUs. And it's not a 62, it's a 63. He realized that she thought he was testing her, seeing if she really did know cars, and obviously she did. So he let that subject die, paused, laughed apologetically, and said, "You've changed since I saw you in Chile last year." "I guess I had to, didn't I?" she said, pushing back a strand of blonde hair with an ungreased patch on the back of her wrist. Harold could see her breath coming fast, chest rising and falling under the denim shirt, blue eyes shining like polished chrome. She reached into her breast pocket and lifted out an unfiltered cigarette. Straight up into her mouth. The cigarette with one small grease mark bobbed unlit as she talked. "One day I'm leading the good life, your basic high-maintenance woman. I mean, hey, my husband owns the biggest car dealership in L.A., so I'm loaded, right? Then my husband My husband disappears. I don't know if he's dead or alive. Suddenly it's up to me to provide for this mansion on the hill. $4,000 a month in mortgage. Plus I find my husband was up to his eyes in debt. And it looks like I might lose everything. I mean everything. So yeah, maybe I have changed. Harold felt this scene wasn't going well. Not at all like he'd pictured it. So he said, maybe I can help. Her hand stopped, lighter halfway to the unlit cigarette. There's only one thing you could tell me that will help. Where's my husband? He paused, wanting to make it easier, but finally said, in the morgue up in Santa Barbara. That stopped her cold, and he could almost hear her thinking, so he really is dead then. He really is dead. And in that moment he saw the attitude fall away like a mask, and she was fresh and vulnerable and very beautiful. A phone began ringing inside the big house, and she said, I'm sorry, and pushed past him and disappeared inside. Through the door he could hear her voice, unsteady as she said, yeah, it's still for sale, a 63 Mark III with a rebuilt engine. I'm asking $7,000, but make me an offer. Harold stood there in the silent garage, smelling the gasoline and carburetor cleaner and thinking how, when he had seen her last, she was a California blonde. A bimbo, really. Not his type at all. But she wasn't perfect anymore. She was angry and banged up and even aged a little bit. And that changed everything. A woman like this he could go for. Besides that, it was great to find a woman he could talk cars with.
That's great. That's a great opening.
Thanks.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm talking with mystery author Philip Reed. You've had your hands into a lot of different types of writing. How did you get into writing mysteries?
It was really, you know, the last thing I did. I tried everything else. But oddly enough, you know, I think this is the target I was shooting for right from the beginning. I was a police reporter for a long time. So right away, I had lots of information and a working firsthand knowledge of how the cops work and mm-hmm. how, not only that, but the justice system. I covered lots of murder trials. So I had the basic feeling for how it really happens in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, I realized how freaky it can be. So I was drawing from real life, not from other movies. But I wrote plays, and I think that really helped me with my dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote screenplay, and that's a wonderful education in crafting stories. So then I'd reached this point where I thought, I think I'm ready for a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to bring screenwriting and playwriting and police reporting together in the style that I use.
How did you come to write for TV, Miami Vice and such?
Well, I did my plays in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And every time the very first play was a play called True Blues, and it was based on an incident I saw as a police reporter in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I got real good reviews. And so a friend said, well, why don't you send the reviews to Hill Street Blues, which was running at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did, and they came and saw it, and they recommended me to the guys that were doing Miami Vice.
How wonderful.
Yeah. So I wrote one of the first episodes of Miami Vice.
Interesting. The title of your first book, Bird Dog, mm-hmm. what does that mean?
Well, a bird dog is somebody that has a loose association with a car dealership. And what he does is he sends people into the dealership to buy a car. And those people think they have the inside track and they're going to get a good deal. But really, it's the reverse. They get taken to the cleaners.
Interesting.
And he gets a kickback of a couple of $100 for each person he sends in.
Mm.
So that's how it works.
Mm.
A bird dog, of course, is a very familiar term in many slang terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just anybody who goes and gets something and brings it back.
Mm. Who, when you were learning your craft, who were the writers that you enjoyed reading or that you learned from?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm sort of proud of is that I've gone outside the genre of thrillers and mysteries. I really learned a lot from certain playwrights. Harold Pinter
mm-hmm.
is somebody that I really admire, but also Arthur Miller, the playwright. But then going, some of the novelists, well, for example, I like Raymond Carver,
mm-hmm.
who's a great short story writer. And in everything that he writes, I mean, he's not writing mysteries, but there's a sense of mystery and
mm-hmm.
suspense and despair, really, in many of his things. But then if you want to talk in the genre, I really like Patricia Highsmith, who
mm-hmm.
wrote the Ripley series, which now Hollywood's going crazy over. You know, they're making 2 or 3 Ripley movies
mm-hmm.
now. So those are some of the people. But probably more than anybody else, James M. Cain is the guy
mm-hmm.
that I really like.
Interesting. You talked earlier about writing over the top. What's your revision process like? And is part of that toning it down? Or talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, of course I always want to find the dumb lines and cut them out, things that are going to make me look stupid. But as we've already talked, you know, it's a fine line. And, you know, like that one line that I just read, you know, there was nothing as sexy as a woman with grease on her hands and a chip on her shoulder.
I like that line. I remember reading it when I was reading the book. And this is a good line.
Yeah, well, I...
This tells you about the character, tells you about the woman.
My pen was poised above it, I have to tell you, you know. And maybe a lot of people wished I had cut it. But when something comes to you like that and it just sort of comes fully developed, and you shouldn't doubt it, you know, you should put it down. So, yeah, I mean, it's just revisions to me. I mean, I think I do cut a lot. It really depends. You know, like with Bird Dog, I wrote it very slowly, but I hadn't been published as a novelist yet. So unless it was just dead on, I didn't write it. So the revision was rather easy. With Lowrider, I only had a year to write it, so I wrote it very quickly, and I, as a result, I wound up writing several drafts.
Are you a big plotter and outliner? Do you spend a lot of time just
I wish I was.
Figuring it out?
I think it would be easier if I was. I think everybody agrees that that's the hardest part, to sit there and ask yourself what's going to happen next, and make it something that's really feels real. You know, people have said my novels seem bizarre, and yet they're believable. I mean, it doesn't seem bizarre to me, but I like to be unpredictable, you know. So what you're trying to do is feel your way along and come up with things that people don't predict. But once they see them, it seems realistic. So I have a sort of my process right now is I try and create a beginning that I really believe in and that I can build on. And then I work slowly and I kind of work on an outline as I go. Before I ever start writing, I like to know what the beginning, middle, and end are in a very broad sense.
Do you have? Are you in a writer's group? Do you give your drafts to anyone to read to get feedback on before you keep going?
Yeah. I was just in Philadelphia, you know, for the Anthony Awards, and a place, you know, was filled with writers. And it seems like most writers have a support group that they work with and show their material to. And some of them literally have writers' groups. Published novelists are in writers' groups. I don't, because I think that I struggled for a long time to achieve a sense of believing in myself. And so I have a very small core of people, including my agent, who really has to be behind it. And I had the good luck to have a guy who edited Bird Dog. He's now retired. And he has time to read, and he edited Lowrider in sort of an unofficial manner. So that by the time it went to the publishing house, it was pretty well polished.
Interesting. How did you find your agent? What sort of
Well, I've got a funny story about that. I'd finished writing this book, Bird Dog, about car salesmen and the scams that they pull. And when I say scams, I don't mean necessarily things that are against the law. You know, I'm just talking gray area, which kind of fascinates me, really.
With the salesman leaving the room, leaving you in the room, coming back with a better offer.
Letting you bake in there. Oh, there's all sorts of fun stuff. But anyways, I had a little knowledge of the psychology that they use on you. So I thought, well, here I am, because I had finished the book and I had it pretty well polished. So I had a complete thing to sell. It wasn't an outline or 100 pages or anything. So I decided that I would pretend that I was a car salesman selling, you know, a book instead of a car, essentially, and use the same techniques. And so I wrote this letter that was over the top. There's that phrase again. And see, one of the things that car salesmen do is they want you to buy today because they want you to feel that it's going to get away if you don't buy it today. If I offer you the right price, will you buy today? They try and trap you with questions like that. So my query letter was somewhat similar. And it started out saying something like, I have just finished a page-turning thriller, and I'd like you to place it with the right publishing house. You see, and it was, I felt that that was a sentence that was fraught with psychology, you know, place it with the right publishing house, not just anyone, you know. And I had just finished writing it. And, you know, the implication was, do you want to be the first one to see this? You better act now or lose a good deal. And I sent it to 5 agents. I've just picked names that I liked from a list. And out of 5, 3 said they didn't have time to read it. And one never responded. And the other one said, called up and sort of laughing, said, I'd like to read your page-turning thriller. So I knew that they, you know, it got to them.
And was that the one?
That was the one. I thought I was going to be so discerning, you know, this time. And I talked to this guy on the phone for 45 minutes, and I said, go to it.
Interesting. Good luck.
Yeah. He's been a great agent. Uh-huh. It was the right move.
What kind of response have you had from readers to your books?
They really, really like Carol Dodge, men and women. I was a little nervous about that, and I'm nervous about the fact that I don't want to be perceived as somebody who writes books about cars.
Mm-hmm.
Both Bird Dog and Low Rider have real juicy women characters in them. In Low Rider, there's a character, Vicky Kovo, you know, works on cars. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, has the ability of a race car driver, and she's very tough and smart, somebody who was tired of being just good-looking and realized, you know, she could do all the things that men did and better.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that the readers have really been much more enthusiastic than I really hoped from the beginning. My fear was that it might be a little too far out there. But what people are saying is, I'm so tired of the normal things,
mm-hmm,
that I'm glad to see something that's different.
Mm-hmm. Marty Smith was on the show at the beginning of the summer, mm-hmm, before the trip the two of you took with your
right.
kids, the book tour. Would you tell us a bit about what happened?
Sure. Well, when Bird Dog came out, I had good reviews, and I wanted to do something with them. So I had this idea that since it was about cars, I should take a trip in a car and promote it, you know? So I took my two boys who were out of school at that time. You know, it was two summers ago. And I did this 5,000-mile trip, going to as many bookstores, independent bookstores particularly, as I could find. Then last fall, I met Martin J. Smith, who wrote Time Release and Shadow Image, at BoucherCon up in Monterey. And I told him what I had done, and he said, well, I've got two kids. You know, maybe what we could do is go on this trip, and you watch my kids, and I'll do signings, and vice versa. So that was kind of the beginning of it, and we rented matching minivans, and we got walkie-talkies so we could talk between the minivans. And we went 6,500 miles. I picked up this minivan. It had 92 miles on it. When I brought it back, it had 6,500 and something. So I got my money's worth.
So how important are book tours? How important was it, do you think, for the two of you to be out there, you know, meeting readers, doing signings?
Mm-hmm. You know, I can't completely answer that. I think, you know, I did my book tour two summers ago, and it took probably 6 months before I really could look back and say, well, this came from that tour. It's a very sort of a grassroots approach. What we really did was we hit the independents with the idea, mm-hmm, that if we met one independent bookseller, that could be 30 sales there, you know, because they each have at least 30 very loyal customers that could buy the book. For example, the Mysterious Bookshop sold 300 copies of Bird Dog and more of Low Rider. That's just one store. So these are significant sales. Everybody talks about the chains, and they think that this means success. But I'm not sure at my level that that's where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of doing publicity, it's so hard to know, you know, but it's what I can do. And I want to do something to help my writing. I mm-hmm. like doing this. I'd like to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a website, or do you, you know, do any other things to get your name out there?
I don't have a website. A lot of writers do. I know Marty does, mm-hmm. Marty Smith. One of the reasons I don't have a website is I've just been lazy about creating it. People find me, or, you know, not a lot, mm-hmm. but people find me through email. They find me out of the phone book. A lot of people have gotten lots of calls, starting with, are you the Phil Reed that wrote Bird Dog?
Hmm.
You know, and then goes on from there. Mm-hmm. So I feel I'm here. And people that are really into books are not shy about trying to find authors.
Hmm.
There are people out there who sort of collect authors.
Yeah. Do you still write nonfiction?
Well, I wrote this book, Free Throw, you know, and that was before Bird Dog. And I had this concept that I wanted to get into sports, writing sports books.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this great idea for a sports book, which I wrote a proposal, and I'm going to haul it out and circulate it, I think. So I'd like to keep going with that, yeah.
What is it about nonfiction that that makes you want to keep going with it?
Well,
because a lot of writers start writing fiction and say, oh, I'm not going back.
Yeah.
To
in fact, my agent said, if you can write fiction, do it. There's not many people that can, you know. I don't necessarily agree. I read a lot of nonfiction books that are not very well written. I like teaching, you know, and if you're writing a nonfiction instructional book like in sports, that's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are things that I want to learn, and sometimes I can't find out the answers to them. And then when I do, I sort of feel like I should share them. because it took a long time. Mm-hmm. Like Free Throw, this Free Throw book. There's not a lot of information about free throw shooting, mm-hmm. and it's desperately needed, as you know, by watching the NBA.
It's 6:55.
Oh.
Any last words for the writers listening?
For the writers, yeah.
For the writers. We have devoted listeners, you know, and even people tuning in through the internet now.
Absolutely. Sure. Well, you know, I think it's just a thrill to look back and say that a year and a half ago, I wasn't a published novelist, and I've crossed some sort of a threshold. And if I can do it, I think, you know, there's an awful lot of other people that can. I think that, you know, developing a sense of what is good and what you really want to say is the most important thing, and that's my recommendation. That's what did it for me, I guess I'd have to say.
Well, I thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Philip Reed, author of Low Rider.